abnormal gene sequence in their entire body. And what happens is mutations come up sporadically. Most are unfavorable. Some lesser are inconsequential, and a few are actually beneficial. So if you somehow mutate so that you have less melanin production in your skin, and you happen to have migrated up into the northern heights where the amount of sunlight is very low and you need sunlight to produce vitamin D, then it's your survival is improved. So those people with less pigmentation survive better under those circumstances. If you were living in Africa, you would probably survive better with more melanin, which would protect you from the UV light and the mutagenic effects of that on your skin. So that's sort of the short version of it.
Would that be sort of answer to the question, what distinguishes Homo sapiens from other living beings and the group of mammals? What makes them different? Different interaction.
Well, I mean, personally, that's a vague question. They're all different. Gene sequences, you might think that some things are identical, although on further investigation, there are millions of different species of insects out there, and they're all a little bit different. Human beings to us are special because we're them, and because as far as we're aware, we have the greatest cognitive ability of any species on this planet. So we lord it over the rest of the beasts of the world.
There was a research done by Hospital Dermar Medical Research Institute, and the researchers analyzed the already sequenced genomes of 68 mammals and different 6,000 families of genes that are only found in those animals. There are genes with no homologous outside mammals in the world that are not present in other hairless species. In humans, it is estimated that they represent 2.5% of the genes that code for proteins. So if we now go to the primary question, the distinctive difference between Homo sapiens and other mammals, or would we actually get to some answers?
I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at here with that, Wesley. Like I said, it's just a survival of the fittest type of mode. Fortunately, our evolutionary branch really maximized cognitive abilities over other things that it could have. I mean, if you were in a fight with a gorilla, chances are the gorilla would kill you. They're bigger, they're stronger, but they're not as bright as you are. So depending upon the situation, they evolved better survivability in a world without us, but not in a world with us. But I'm not quite sure what you're trying to get at.
Every cell in the body of every living organism contains deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. So it's the self-replicating material that passes of hereditary traits from one generation to the other. So my question was that we have a certain information that are encoded in the sequences of those of the chemicals, which are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. when we're talking about a human sharing DNA with each other and with other animals, we're basically talking about the sequencing pattern, because all DNA contains the same four chemical bases. And based on that, I was trying to formulate myself in such a way that the only significance between us and other human and non-human ancestors is cognitive ability. Am I right?
I would kind of disagree. We have other interesting features in addition. We have a little bit better general stature than our simian relatives. They're really kind of four-footed. We're kind of the upright cousin in the family. Also, we are able to vocalize the signals a lot better than they are. Their larynx is not evolved for complex sounds, although their brain is capable of some degree of language processing. They can actually teach gorillas to do sign language, but you can't teach a chimpanzee or a gorilla to talk. They simply lack the structures inside. Now, there are creatures that can simulate talk. Birds can mimic human voice, but without any kind of cognitive attachment to what the words mean.
So research shows that 99.9% of genetic information is DNA. In DNA is common for all human beings. So how do we differ? The remaining 0.01, so 100%, is responsible for differences in hair, eye, skin color, height, and vulnerability to the certain diseases. And it is believed by inside world that all life evolved from common ancestor, which means that humans are that humans also share DNA sequences with other living organisms, and humans share DNA with creatures closer in evolutionary line and with common ancestors to a greater extent than with those future removed. And then what those who are future removed are those who actually died out due to the climatic changes. So top of the list are great apes, so with the lesser apes, monkeys, and prosimians are a little further removed. Other mammals are further still followed by insects, plants, and more rudimentary lipoforms. The question is, if we have a common ancestor, could you comment on that common ancestor? And to actually...
Well, I can't exactly tell you what it was. Most likely, it was a single-celled organism, and probably it started off as a much smaller organism, much more simpler bacteria, because way back a long, long time ago, life did not really use oxygen. The surface of the earth had no oxygen in it. Oxygen is a reactive gas left to itself without any means to produce it. It oxidizes and leaves the atmosphere. So when finally a bacteria evolved that could split water into oxygen and get chemical energy using photons as the source of the energy, it basically poured oxygen into the atmosphere, killing a lot of anaerobic bacteria that couldn't survive on the oxygen until a bacteria evolved that was capable of actually utilizing oxygen for its metabolism. It got swallowed by another cell and became a little organelle called a mitochondria, and cells with mitochondria became animal cells, and those with chloroplasts became plant cells.
Okay, so now, in atmosphere of Venus, it was found a gas known as sulfate. And sulfate is actually a kind of gases that is released by human body as well. And everybody knows that gas. Was that assumption of the single cell organism leading to the process of evolution on the Earth claim that it is possible that the atmosphere of Venus is full of life? So let me say a few words. Venus' atmosphere is composed 96.5% from carbon dioxide, and there's actually in line with what you said about using oxygen, 3.5 nitrogen, and the percent of nitrogen and traces of other gases, most notably sulfur dioxide. Analysis of the data from Venera, another name, was done by Pioneer and Magellan missions and found that hydrogen sulfide is present there. Only recently it was found that that sulfide is present in the outer atmosphere, outer layer of the atmosphere of Venus, and that's why there is a sign of possible life there. And to Xia.
Well, Wesley, I think you were alluding to the phosphine that was detected via spectroscopy. There have been some new papers recently that throw a lot of cold water on that. One paper suggests that there are mechanisms of possible volcanoes on that planet that generate that phosphine. And far worse, there's another group of scientists who seem to suggest that the algorithm, the smoothing algorithm that they use to interpret the data was incredibly flawed. They took the same noisy signals from far away from the site of the phosphine. They used the previous people's smoothing algorithms, and all of a sudden the noise appeared to be the spectral analysis for phosphine. So it's very possible that the analysis was flawed fundamentally.
Of course, I was alluding to phosphine. I didn't want to say the word because I didn't know it's appropriate. My knowledge of English is not that great to recognize whether I'm just crossing lines and to exchange.
Yeah, in addition, someone else reported a preliminary non-peer-reviewed analysis that suggested that glycine was in the atmosphere. Glycine is a sugar, organic, it may be able to be formed in other types of situations. But another reviewer suggested that the spectrographic analysis that suggested glycine might just be actually hydrogen sulfide, which is not really as good a case to make for organic life as if you found actual glycine. So I think there's a lot of well-meaning researchers who are going off, say, half-cocked. And when the dust settles, I think our dream of life on that planet will be diminished a bit.
Yeah, yet we have another similarity, so all my talk starting from the beginning is a chain connection between one event and to the other. So we're talking about phosphine gas that was found in Venus. The atmosphere may be a possible sign of life. Astronomers detect signs of smelly toxic gas that microbes can make in the planet clouds Venus atmosphere. Shown here, shown in the false color image from Japan Akatsuki spacecraft, and that was known the best by choking clouds of sulfuric acid. But then we're coming back to what you said, that life began from the single cell and from very much primitive microbes later on, when the cells evolved to that form. And by that, we could assume that if it's such, then we have possibility of life in Venus. And to actually...
Is it possible? Yes, it's possible. Is it likely? No, it's not likely. As I said before, it'll be interesting to see other people review the documentation of these researches right now. It may just be an erroneous error in their smoothing equations for the noisy signal that they're dealing with, and it may completely disappear from the final results. We'll see. I wouldn't have your heart set on finding little green men on Venus, but I'm always for more information, never for less.
Dr. Rui, my friend, I love your skepticism. This is the best thing that is in you, and it is helpful for self-control and consciousness, healthy consciousness. I do thank you for that. There is another subject that not today, because we're going to be close to the time frame that is allowed for us to talk about different subjects. Let me drop. But more close to the ham radio, and which would be the waves and propagation and in the area of propagation, something that is called interface, and that would be surface waves, and the one of the form of it is Zenneck wave, and to Xia.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for your friends in Texas to make their announcement. But, you know, it's 10:18. It's time to bring on Paul with the SpaceNet report. So I'd like to just remind people of the different URLs and such, and then turn it over to Paul.
I do thank you very much. It was a wonderful evening. I was able to express myself. We had a little longer time for not really very much technical issues. Thank you for that, and to Xia.
You're welcome, Wes. Thank you for your participation in this. Once again, want to remind everyone, I don't think we've had a mailbag question in about months. In the old days, good John used to talk about having 40, 50, 60 mailbag questions. I don't know where he got them from. But if you have a mailbag question, or if you have a topic you'd like to hear discussed, or you've heard or read a puzzle that you think might be appropriate to try out here, or you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a website or a video or a news item on space, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. URL to my link page, a couple of interesting pictures of asteroids, some articles that Wesley alluded to, is available at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, keep in mind that Mike KC2NJI maintains an archive of technical nets. that is go as far back as September of 2006. And it's great to listen to Dick and to Mel and to John and to Eric and all the great guys that have unfortunately become Silent Keys. So when you have a chance, check it out. So thanks again to everyone. And now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with WS2N Paul.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good. On a good net so far. Very interesting. Different topics than what I'm used to. DNA and all. But, okay. There's always something new with the space program. And maybe, you know, now the administration has changed over, they might start approving different long-term missions to talk about. That's kind of been on hold for a while. That tends to happen right before any big elections. But there are always ongoing missions, and there's always things that have been approved years ago that are still in the works. So that's how we're able to keep going here on the net. I always started off with the next important launches, and there's really one that I'd like to mention, which is going to be this Saturday at 7:49, and that's going to be the Crew 1 Dragon spacecraft that's going to take off from. That over 50 shuttles took off from, and also where the Saturn V rocket used to take off from to bring astronauts to the moon, and now SpaceX runs that entire launch complex 39A. So they'll be launching to the International Space Station. You have a crew of four. Unlike the crew of two that we had back in May when Behnken and Hurley went up, they went up on a test, really. It was a test flight to make sure the crew vehicle would work properly, you know, with the crew on board. They had sent up a mission before that, unmanned, docked to the space station, and then came back and landed in the water. And then they had Behnken and Hurley go up last May. They stayed for a couple of months and returned safely. They were supposed to land in the Atlantic Ocean, but due to weather, they wound up landing in the Gulf of Mexico. But everything went well. They learned a lot from that flight. They made some relatively minor changes, they said, to the vehicle. But now they're able to go into a regular regular operation of sending crews up and bringing them down on a regular basis. And this time they're sending four people up. Four astronauts, I mentioned more before, Shannon Walker, who also has to be a ham radio operator. She's KD5DXB, Michael Hopkins, KF5LJG, Victor Glover, KI5BKC, and Sochi Nagochi, which is KD5TVP. He's from JAXA, which is the Japan Space Agency. NASA will be flying people up from from the European Space Agency, from Japan, from different countries, over the country. Months and being all hams, they'll probably take their turns at making contacts with students on Earth. And my guess, a fellow from Japan will be making student contacts with Japan, and the rest of them will be most likely the United States. Looking forward to that. They'll be launching on a Falcon 9 rocket. That rocket has 1.7 million pounds of thrust when it takes off. The booster, main booster, is around 159 feet tall. That will be returning to a drone ship out in the sea, and they'll reuse that booster in the future. And the second stage will have another Merlin engine on board, Merlin D engine. The Falcon 9 has 9, and Merlin D has 1. That will take them to the orbit that they need. The that stage will separate, and that will deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere. But the crew vehicle has its own engines. It's got what they call a trunk on the back, which in the old days we used to call that the service module. When NASA had them for Gemini and for Apollo. And, you know, it supplies a lot of important environmental controls and things for the spacecraft itself. And eventually that would, that'll go up with the space station. And then when it deorbits, that trunk separates, and that's the only piece that burns up, and the spacecraft will come back through the atmosphere with a heat shield, a Piker X heat shield, they call it, and eventually the four parachutes will come out, and they land in the water, and they'll be picked up by their own SpaceX ship. They stay on board the vehicle, and these hydraulics put the spacecraft on a SpaceX ship. After 6 months of being in space, they really can't walk. They kind of carry them out. They have a crew there to carry them out and bring them into a medical facility. They get checked out. Eventually, they get put on a helicopter and sent back to Houston. Anyway, looking forward to that launch, nighttime launch from Florida, again at 7:49 p.m. I'm sure that will make the news, sending a crew of four up on one of those spacecraft. So, they've got it where when they launch, the International Space Station will be right overhead in Florida. And this way they're able to keep the time short before they dock. They can stay, the spacecraft itself is... could stay a couple of days if it took that long to get to the space station. But as long as it's right directly above and directly in line with the inclination as the Earth is spinning, they could immediately dock with that space station inside of it. I think they said 6.5 hours, roughly two orbits or something like that. But they'll be there quick instead of a two-day deal. Which of course would be a little cramped on the Dragon crew vehicle, but they have that capability with four people. So that's the story on that. They have a patch that every crew has a patch, and they have their patch and shows an eagle with a spacecraft superimposed on that, and then with the number one because this is the first. Even so, they had a test flight with Bob Henkin and Doug Hurley in May. This is the first actual crew rotation, the beginning of a systematic restocking of a crew to the International Space Station. So they're calling it Crew One. So on a patch is the number one, and they don't have any names. Usually they put their names around the circumference of the patch. And this time they're not doing it. They chose not to do it. They wanted to just make it where this is representative of all the people that have been involved with SpaceX and NASA to get them where they're going. So any questions about this launch? This is WS2F. Okay. The new crew vehicles do not have solar panels that come out, so they've eliminated that. And they have on the trunk, back part of that spacecraft is loaded with solar cells. and that's how they produce power. I think they get up to around enough to run 4K, 4,000 watts of energy into Dragons. So I think they have plenty of power. And then when they're connected to the space station, they shut that down, and they just pick up the power from the space station itself. There's plenty of power on the International Space Station, so they have ways of tapping into it. You know, after they dock, there's connections that are automatically made where they can do that. The early shuttles didn't have that. It was dock, and the shuttles just ran on their own power. They had their fuel cells on board that generate electricity, so their missions tended to run a little shorter, but as time went on, the shuttle also developed a jumping capability with the space station. And then you found out, you realized that the shuttles were now, instead of staying for 5 or 6 days, they were starting to stay for, 12 days, 13, I think they had the capability of staying up to 18 days on station. So that's that story. Any questions before I move on? This is okay. Another spacecraft that's been under development, really by NASA. I mean, this is really a NASA spacecraft, is the Orion spacecraft. And that's been under development, probably for 12 years now, maybe more. Ever since they realized they would come to the end of the space shuttle program, a couple of years before that, they started developing Orion. And Orion was originally going to be launched on different kinds of rockets called the... they had a program called Constellation that they eventually canceled, but they kept the Orion spacecraft itself. And what happened was they started to develop a new idea of what they were going to build, and they came up with the SLS system, the Space Launch System, which consists of a big large tank, bigger than the external tank they used to use on the shuttle, containing liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. And they're going to run four rocket engines on the bottom of this whole setup. And the crew is going to be in the Orion on top of it. So you're sitting on top of the external tank they used to use for the shuttle. Well, you'd be like sitting on top of it, except this one's actually even bigger. And they'll have four engines. The space shuttle used to have three engines, so this one will have four. Originally designed for five for the SLS, for the Space Launch System, but they cut it back down to four. And these are the same engines that they used to use, the RS-25 engines. And with that, they have two solid boosted, also attached to the setup, one on the port side, one on the starboard side. And each one runs 3.5 million pounds of thrust. So combined, you have 7 million pounds of thrust for the solid booster rockets. And since each one of these RS-25 engines that they used to use for shuttle, now they're going to use for SLS, run a little over 500,000 pounds of thrust. So totally, because you have four of them there, you got 2 million pounds with the 7 million from the solid, you're running 9 million pounds of thrust, which is more than the Apollo used to run. Apollo used to have 7.5 million pounds of thrust to go to the moon. This thing's now going to have 9. And the reason I'm talking about it is they finally got to the point where they're actually starting to make a lot of headway. Orion has been built by Lockheed Martin for the correction of Boeing. Boeing's involved with that. And the European Space Agency has built the back end of it, the service module. and these two pieces both have been attached together. And they're getting to that point where this whole assembly will eventually be put on the top of the SLS rocket. Probably, I don't know, maybe, definitely next year, probably, I'm guessing July or August, for a trip around the moon. Although Orion spacecraft would be able to hold up to four people for a trip to the moon, and someday it will. For now, it's not going to have anybody. Right now, they just want to make sure that this whole setup, the SLS rocket, which is the big external tank, the two big solid boosters, the four RS-25 engines that are going to be launching this thing, plus the Orion spacecraft on top, along with the European Space Agency service module that's going to be attached to the back, all work together. So they're sending it to the moon. So there's, you know, no landing vehicle on it. And they let it orbit the moon, for multiple orbits. And I think collectively, I think it's going to be a couple of week mission. And then deorbit the moon and fly it all the way back to Earth. And make sure the heat shield works properly, although they've actually done a test with that, the heat shield, back to 2014, but they want to make sure everything works. They upgraded everything since then, including the parachutes, and they will eventually land in the ocean, Pacific Ocean. And it won't be SpaceX picking them up, it will be the U.S. Navy with their ship. So that's the story on that. The reason I bring it up is they're finally moving along. I don't talk about it that much. I mean, this is a real NASA project designed by NASA. They pay contractors to build it, but it's a different deal than with the commercial setup. For instance, SpaceX, NASA just pays them money and says, here, you design it, you build it, and, the best way you know how, and then show us what you got. We'll approve it for use. So it's a different way of doing things. NASA's old system is design it themselves and then have contractors build it to their specifications. The new system, commercial flights such as SpaceX or what they're doing with the Starliner program is, you come to us and show us what you have, and we'll help pay for it, and eventually we'll be our customers. We'll pay you, for instance, $50 million, I think, a seat to go to the International Space Station. So these four guys that are going up, four crew members that are going up on Saturday, NASA will be paying them roughly $200 million to do that. Outside of the money that they've also chipped in to help develop the rockets, develop the spacecraft and all. So that's the story with Orion. They eventually will send a crew there. We'll talk about that shortly. In fact, that'll be my next topic. Unless anybody has any questions or comments, this is WS2. Like I said, to talk about what they plan on doing as far as once they get to the moon. Now, let's make sure this first, all-up test of what I was just talking about, SLS and Orion, unmanned, get to orbit the moon, get to deorbit the moon, come back to Earth safely, and now they know they can put a crew on it. You can probably wait another 6 months or a year before that happens. Once they do that, they have plans on actually landing on the moon, not on that mission. That will again be an orbital mission except with the crew. The one after that, they call it Artemis 3. The first one is Artemis 1, uncrewed. Artemis 2 is with a crew around the moon. And then Artemis 3, they would like to try to make a landing but you're going to need a landing vehicle to do that. So they've contracted three companies, three big aerospace companies, and a fourth one, not as popular, to develop this landing system. So you can imagine Orion going all the way out to the moon. What are they going to do? They can't land in the Orion spacecraft. They can't land in the service module that's supplying all the fuel and all the life support system for the vehicle. They're going to need a landing vehicle. In the old days with Apollo, what they did is they sent up the Saturn V and the Apollo spacecraft and the lunar lander all went in one. So the Apollo spacecraft would turn around 180 degrees. That's before that upper stage, and then the LEM lander and the spacecraft power would go to the moon, and that's the way they did it. The lander would land on the moon, the upper stage would come back, and dock with Orion, Apollo, and then come back to Earth. This is going to be a different setup. They have the lander being built by Blue Origin, the descent element, and then they have the ascent module along with the crew in it to leave the moon is being built by Lockheed. Back in the 60s when this Apollo LEM thing was being built, the LEM, which was the descent module and the ascent module, was all built by one company, Northrop Grumman. So here they have Blue Origin building the descent module for the ascent module. Instead of bringing in Northrop Grumman, they brought in Lockheed, and Lockheed is supposed to build the ascent module. So that's how they would get down to the moon and then leave. But there's another piece involved with this whole new setup. It's called the transfer spacecraft. It's a transfer element. Another spacecraft that's going to be reusable. What happens is this whole setup, the descent and then the ascent module will eventually dock with the transfer vehicle. The transfer vehicle will bring it down to a low lunar orbit. The transfer vehicle will stay in low lunar orbit, and then this whole set, the whole setup, descent and ascent, will land on the moon and then return. The ascent module will come back up and dock with the transfer vehicle. The transfer vehicle would then go a little higher in orbit, dock with Orion. Orion, which brought the crew to the moon, would fly back to Earth. So you need a whole bunch of different launches to get the stuff here. They're going to incorporate commercial launches, like from SpaceX. We now have, they're going to get the crew there. NASA's going to have the Orion spacecraft. They're going to have the SLS launch vehicle. And that will send the crew module along with the service module that was built by European Space Agency to lunar orbit. That, in turn, would dock with the descent and ascent module. And the transfer module, all of these things would be docked together. It'd be in lunar orbit. From there, the transfer module and the two other pieces, descent and ascent, would separate from Orion. Orion would stay in orbit with nobody on board, just autonomously fly by itself, not like the old days. The old days with Apollo, you sent two people down, and they landed on the moon, and you left one guy in the Apollo vehicle. Here they'll take all four people, leave the Orion all by itself, and then all go down to the moon for a couple of weeks, especially in the beginning, a couple of weeks. That will eventually change over time. for longer periods of time. But, you know, the first landing would stay for a couple of weeks. Descent module would take all four back up, dock with the transfer vehicle, and the transfer vehicle would go up a little higher and dock with the Orion spacecraft. That would separate from the transfer vehicle. That transfer vehicle, remember, that's reusable. I'll get to that in a minute. And Orion would come back to Earth. So that would be Artemis 3. You know, that's the third mission. One is unmanned. That'll be done next year, followed by a manned mission to the moon, orbiting the moon and returning to Earth, followed by Artemis 3, which is this whole complex setup. But the reason you need this whole transfer vehicle, you would say, well, what is the vehicle? Is because the following missions after that, Artemis 4, 5, 6, they plan on having something called Gateway in permanent lunar orbit. Gateway is going to be a space station. Not as big as the International Space Station, but pretty big. You know, maybe consisting of like three or four, maybe five different modules, habitat module, and so on and so forth. For a permanent crew of maybe four on board, you know, you'll be able to have these people living there on a regular basis. Yeah, in the beginning they might stay for, you know, a month or two, but that time will, again, increase over time. But this permanent crew will be in orbit, but a very high orbit, you know, not like 60 or 100 miles above the surface. It's going to be I believe 40,000 miles above the surface. And then, they call it a halo orbit. So it'll be hanging out by the moon. So all missions in the future, this is their plan, it will be to launch, you know, eventually you're going to have to refuel this transfer vehicle that's attached to the Gateway system. They'll be sending refueled rockets up from Earth. They'll be sending Orion spacecraft with the European Space Agency attached on another rocket to eventually go to this halo orbit and dock with the space station, the Gateway space station. And then from there, they could live in there for a while, and then eventually separate Gateway, leave a crew on board Gateway. They're staying there on a regular basis. But the crew that is going down to the surface will board the descent and transfer vehicle. Now, this is why you need that transfer vehicle. So it's a big module. It's a big section with tons of fuel in it. That will de-orbit this 40,000 mile orbit, and then eventually get into a low lunar orbit, you know, maybe 60 miles above the surface, and then from there the lander and the descent module will go down to the surface. So that's why they want to incorporate this transit vehicle, especially early on. They need to work with it, see how everything works together before they get involved with the Gateway. Anyway, that's NASA's plan. I don't know if I explained it correctly, but if anybody has any questions, I'm here. This is WS2N for any comments or questions. U2CHB. I missed the beginning. All I heard was HB at the end. Go ahead.
W2CHB. I was wondering if you think they're going to have radios at this moon base, and what would be involved in getting in touch with them as amateurs? Is that even a possibility?
You know, I've been on this net a long time. I mean, I can't remember when I first started with this net. It's got to be, wow, I don't know, 2000 or something. And I remember asking Dick that question. When we eventually go back to the moon, I would have it, you know, a permanent moon base and have some, you know, I'm sure there's going to be amateurs. You know, right now you have amateurs going up on Saturday to the space station. There's going to be amateurs on the moon, and it should be no big deal to have a transmitter from the moon, and they'll be able to make contact with Earth I figured by now, cause that was a long time ago, I figured by now, well, we'll be back to the moon. By now, I thought I would have had my QSL card from the moon. Back to you.
So have there been any ideas on whether, I don't even know, would they be using VHF or UHF to do that, or would it have to be a higher frequency?
Yeah, well, you know, they could, if you have enough power, you could do it, you know, you could probably even use 2 meters, but my guess is that it'll probably be high frequencies. You know, on a regular basis, for instance, NASA uses the S-band, they use the S-band for communications when they were at the moon. What's that, 2 point? I don't know, I think that's around 3 gig. So, you know, they'll probably have stuff like that. But I could even envision 1.2, which is, you know, one of the amateur, you know, frequencies. I could see 1.2 as a possibility. Then they were thinking, well, I've heard or read stories probably from AMSAT where they would put a transmitter, you know, even if you don't have a crew, just have a transmitter and have a robotic type of communications, similar to what we have with these, like a dove satellites that go overhead, you can transmit up and, you know, you get a signal back, but this, you know, I could envision packet type of communications with the moon, and that would be great. But, you know, there would be nothing like having a QSO with some guy that's sitting on the moon. It's exciting just contacting somebody in Antarctica or a lake. I've always tried to do that. Haven't been able to do that yet. Imagine some guys in the South Pole, you know, making contact with you. That happens on a regular basis. I can see it happening on the moon. Back to you.
Yeah, I've been trying to reach Antarctica, and I've been trying to reach the astronauts on the space station, and just using the repeater on the space station has been a lot of fun. And, you know, the moon is direct line of sight, so I'd love to see that happen in my lifetime, and to think it could happen in the next couple of years is really exciting stuff. Back to you.
It certainly is, and, I got involved with a school that did it once, and Limock has done that, but I got involved with my daughter's a ham teacher, and she got involved with a school that did that, and we contacted Jack Fitcher, but that's a planned contact. It's possible that astronauts would have some free time, and maybe, I'm sure it still happens, they'd go into the Columbus module, and that's where the Kenwood radio is. And I could see these, you know, somebody transmitting down and making a contact just out of the, you know, just pure luck making contact like that. That would be really something. I mean, you read about things like that happening in QST. It happens. But the most common ones, of course, are the school contacts. And they'll be doing that. Or they do it all. I forget how many, I think they're up to over 1,000 different schools over the last 20 years doing this. So, yeah, it's entirely possible. At one time, the shuttles, before the ISS, had a SAREX program, a Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment Program. Let me drop it. So they would do the same thing. They would try to make contacts with hams on the ground. And sometimes, the school deal wasn't as popular, but they would just make contacts, you know, whenever they had free time. And they said, if you ever hear them going overhead, I used to leave my radio on that frequency all the time. And I knew who was up there, and sure enough, they were going overhead one time, and I heard them making contact with the station. And what NASA had back then was, if you hear them, you know, you could, you know, you write down the information, who they contacted, whatever, and you can send it in, and they'd send you an SWL card, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it looks like a QSL card. They'd send you one. And I did that with STS 145. It was the Atlantis mission, March of 1992. And that was pretty cool. I mean, it wasn't a two-way contact, but I got to hear them direct. Back to you.
Yeah, I've been listening for them. You know, I keep it on in my car, and I keep it on at home sometimes, when like later at night. And I haven't heard them yet, but I have seen some guys on YouTube that have made contacts with them. Usually they're piggybacking off of a planned contact and kind of squeezing in there and making a quick contact with the station. So I'm keeping my eyes peeled for it, and, you know, eventually I'd like to get that QSL card from the space station. I got one for the SSTV that they did a couple months ago. They sent me, I haven't gotten the card yet, but I sent the information for it, and, you know, just getting those images off the space station is really cool, and, you know, the prospect of doing it from the moon is incredible.
Okay, that was the one where the Russians were transmitting slow scan TV down to Earth for the anniversary of Sputnik. Is that the one you just did?
Yeah, that one was like about a month ago, and then the one that I'm getting the card for was, I believe, last December. They did one for, I forget what it was for, but they did it for about 4 or 5 days, and they went over and sent a bunch of images, so I stayed up late and captured a couple, and it was really, really cool.
Yeah, that's great. I saw the results of that. I guess it was AMSAT. They printed, there were a lot of guys like you that did that, and they sent their pictures in, and they got them printed up. You know, so I'm scanning through that, and it looked like a lot of pictures of, I'm trying to remember if that was, I definitely saw a picture of Sputnik, that's why I remember that. So I think it had to do with that. Sputnik was October 4th, 1957, so. I think every year they probably do something like this. So that's pretty cool. That's great that you did that. As far as contacting on 2 meters now, it's weird. The transmit frequencies, you know, it's not an exact number. I remember looking at this the other day. You know, so when you transmit up, it's almost like you need an all-mode rig. You know, like a mobile rig might not work. Unless I figure out how to get some kind of offset transmitting frequency in there to do that. And if you come across that, just take a look at that. Make sure that your rig is set up to transmit up to the space station. You know, otherwise you'll be they're transmitting up on one frequency and it's coming down on another. Back to you.
Yeah, eventually I'd like to get that ICOM 9700 so I can do more of that type of stuff, especially working with the same thing with working these satellites that are up there. The way I've been doing it lately is I have an Yaesu 857D, and I just transmit on one and then switch over to the 440 to hear them coming back to me. And it's not full duplex, so it's, you're kind of walking on people when you do it that way. But it's good practice, and eventually, hopefully, you know, I'll get the correct radio for it. And,
next time, complete.
But working the satellites is super fun, and I've been doing it with a pretty standard quarter-wave antenna, and I'm getting good connections to most of the satellites going over. I can't get to the SSB satellites, but the FM satellites haven't been a problem.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I don't do the satellite contacts at all. But in the beginning, I did. They had different. Well, it was different. You know, they had strange setup. You transmit up on, what was it? I think you transmit on. I was transmitting on. they were using, you know, HF. So did that a couple of times. But that's when I first started you know, to go big. And then they got involved with now all these small satellites, which is really good. It is, I don't know.